Steve Jobs resigns as Apple CEO. HP quits computers. And an LTE iPhone? All that and more on the Slongcast. Slongcast, episode 41 for Tuesday, August 30th, 2011. As usual, I'm your host, Kevin Slonka, and with me, as always, Mr. Ryan Lancey.
Howdy.
If you haven't noticed, I got my radio voice on today.
Yes, you do.
I don't know what came over me.
And if you haven't noticed, I've bought a brand new Asus Transformer.
That is a awesome Android tablet.
Why, thank you.
I must say, I mean, you have it docked right now on a keyboard, but the top half, just the tablet, looks pretty much identical size to my iPad.
Yeah, it's a 16 by 10 display, so it's a little bit different, like, right, dimensions or shape. But I think screen area wise, it's probably about the same.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I like it from the 2 minutes I played with it.
Yeah,
I like the desktop switching, I guess you would call it, when you swipe back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, the animations are cool so far. I like it. I'm not sure if I'm like into the whole tablet thing yet. You know,
it's a niche. I mean,
yeah, we'll see.
I use mine when I'm sitting on the couch watching TV, so I don't have to boot up my laptop.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've had it like 3 days and I haven't touched my laptop in 3 days.
Yeah, that's pretty much what it is. Yeah. Like, yeah. I only really use my laptop to record the show and to develop pictures.
Yeah.
Other than that, the iPad can do everything else.
Yeah. I've actually been thinking of like maybe changing my whole like ecosystem into a full on like desktop again, and then just the tablet.
Oh.
You know, especially since it's like a convertible netbook format.
Yeah, really. It's a laptop now.
Yeah.
So. I mean, you have what? USB ports? You have an SD slot?
Yep.
Yeah, you're good to go.
Yep.
That is awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, let me know how you like it. And, you know, after a couple weeks of using it, see if you still have the fun factor with it.
Cool.
So, top story of the week. And this is huge. I mean, everybody heard of this. Everybody.
What's that?
Steve Jobs, no longer CEO of Apple.
What?
You didn't hear? Are you under a rock?
No, I heard, actually.
Yeah, this is kind of, I want to say, ridiculous. I mean, it's happened before. You know, Steve Jobs has stepped down once before and said, you know what, I'm done. Then he's like, hey, I'm back. But this time, everybody kind of thinks, you know, his health has taken the top priority and he's done for good. And our first article from Ars Technica is an email from Tim Cook, which is the person who has stepped into Steve's previous spot. So Tim Cook now runs Apple. And his email basically said, nothing's going to change. Even though Steve's gone, nothing's going to change. Everything we do is already ingrained in our culture. We're still going to ship awesome products. We're not going to change anything. We're not going to lose our appeal. We're still Apple.
Do you take a little issue with that, though, that we're not going to change? Because I think he actually worded it, we're never going to change. Or something like that, to that effect.
I'm skimming through it right now to see if I see the word never, just to see how he said that.
Even we're not going to change.
I want you to be confident that Apple is not going to change.
Apple's not going to change. Like, I think you almost have to. And here's my take on this. I'm not saying, and I don't think anyone would say, that you need to have someone at the head of your company like Steve Jobs to be successful in any industry. However, I think the way Apple's structured is one type of model. And I've never worked there, and I don't know the ins and outs of it. But on the outside, to me, it's like Steve sets the tone. He sets the policy. And as evidenced from Vic Gundotra's post on Google+, after Steve announced his resignation, you know, he had an anecdote about when Steve called him on a Sunday and he didn't answer the phone because he was in church, he said some kind of religious service, but he was in some sort of religious service. And, you know, he doesn't like to interrupt that for anything, but he didn't recognize the number at the time. And it was around the time Google was releasing some product on the iPhone. And it turned out that he called the number back and it was Steve, and he's like, oh, hey, sorry, I didn't answer the phone. And Steve said, well, you know, you shouldn't answer the phone for anyone in church unless it says God. There's, you know, some light. He's, you know, I'm sure he's a good guy, but he had a very small complaint about the way the Google logo looked on this product that was about to be launched, and he wanted it fixed before they launched it. And, you know, Gundotra commented that, you know, that's what it takes. That's the type of CEO you want, someone that's paying attention to detail. And maybe you do in some companies. You know, maybe that's what it takes. And this isn't to slight any of the employees at Apple. I think they do build very good hardware. I really, you know, credit them with making some of the best some of the best hardware out there. But that said, if it takes that from the CEO to get it, to get you to that point, you know, you better have somebody that really has that passion, because many people that work for a company, even if you love what you do, you're still an employee. Or I think for Steve, it was, you know, this was his baby, and, you know, in essence, you know, it was his company from the ground up.
Yeah, he might have felt that, you know, even though they have thousands of employees now, it was still up to him.
Right.
And I think that's, you know, you, like you said, that's just one way of structuring a company. But I think it's one of the better ways, because if you look, you know, we've talked about this with Microsoft before, in the way that they just have so many people and so many parts of their company that certain people, you know, head up one department that don't know anything about another department, and their products suffer because of it. You don't have that one person in a company like Microsoft that just knows everything and has this. I mean,
I know what you're saying, but I still don't think that Apple's ever been immune to that. In this, you know, and I think a really good example that comes to mind for me is MobileMe.
Oh, that was a,
you know,
bust.
And there's actually a lot of failures over the years that Apple's had. You know, still not discrediting them. Every company has to have these types of failures to make it eventually. Or even when they do make it, you gotta shoot for the stars sometimes.
Right.
But I guess my point is just that I think his statement that Apple won't change, yeah, it sounds reassuring, but they're gonna have to change.
Yeah, it's hard to say whether he meant everything we do is not going to change, or whether he meant, don't worry that I'm taking over, we're still gonna ship awesome products. You know, I think that's what he meant. But the way the email came off, it's like, you know, nothing is going to change.
Yeah.
And you're right, that's not possible.
I just don't think it is.
I think everybody in Apple is going to have to step up now.
Yeah, I mean, I wish no ill to Steve. You know, you can take, if you're a competitor of Apple, this may be an advantage for you with not having him in the chair anymore, driving the ship. But you know, he still deserves credit for what he's done. I don't think that he's been the sole reason, like some credit him with, that the PC industry is the way it is because of Steve Jobs. I think there's been a lot of other critical players along the way, and it's been a community effort from all respects. But he definitely had a big part of it.
Yeah, and like you said, this could be a big opportunity. You know, what was it, 4 years ago that the iPhone came out, which was pretty much Apple coming out of nowhere with a product they had never done anything with before. And now that Steve isn't there to make those critical decisions, they could miss one. You know, there could be something somebody else comes out with and pulls an Apple and out of nowhere enters a market they weren't in before, and bam, they now own the market. So every other company out there, listen up. This is your time to shine. Although,
yeah,
you know, we'll see what happens. Maybe Tim is right. Maybe Apple is not going to change and everything is going to go the way it always would have if Steve was there. Who knows? But one thing they are doing for sure is trying to get around the jailbreaking threat. You know, every company doesn't want their closed hardware and software being used for purposes they didn't come up with. And Apple is definitely one of those companies. What did they do, though? They hired the guy who made the awesome, let me just add in that word there, the awesome jailbreak site, jailbreakme.com. Have you ever seen this site or seen anybody use this site?
I know a little bit about the one where you'd go and just slide.
That's it.
And it would unlock your phone.
That's jailbreakme.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, so I mean, this website, the dude figured out, you know, how to exploit an iPhone, which is, you know, that's what you have to do to jailbreak it. You have to find a vulnerability, exploit it just like a hacker would, in order to gain root privileges to unlock it. And he did this through a web page that looks like the iPhone unlock screen. So you go to jailbreakme.com, you get the little bar at the bottom, slide to jailbreak, just like your phone normally says, slide to unlock. You slide it, it downloads the malicious software, except instead of breaking your thing, it just jailbreaks it for you, which is what you wanted. But this dude was hired by Apple. Do you think this is good? Not only for Apple, but for the jailbreaking community.
Well, I mean, it's not good for the jailbreaking community.
Yeah, because now there's a player gone. You know, he's if he jailbreaks from now on, he'll be fired from Apple.
On the other hand, maybe he'll be able to pull some sort of, make some kind of impression or influence on Apple to change their policies with regards to locking the phones down to such a degree.
That could be. Maybe he'll be an insider for the jailbreakers and ship them information they might not otherwise have.
That's true, too. I'm sure that would, you know, carry stiff penalties.
Oh, I'm sure.
I don't know anyone that's worked at Apple, and I have never worked there myself and never been inside. I'd imagine that the security for their new products and software releases is pretty strong. I would hope it is, because imagine the devastation. I don't know, maybe devastation is the wrong word in light of like hurricane and earthquake.
Well, but in terms of company making money.
Yeah, company making money and just overall impression. If some vulnerability was leaked before the OS was released, and it was something that, you know, someone could take advantage of very maliciously to do something with enough time for them to say prepare some virus.
It would be the world's worst zero day.
Yeah, it would be the world's worst zero. I mean, these are things that could really, really not only sink Apple, but sink, you know, the faith in which we put technology. You know, this is stuff that can happen no matter what you do. So you have to have some sort of security in the way you develop your software, not only in the final product, but in the process with which it's developed.
Right. And I also think the way you use your software too. You know, most people don't realize that anything that has writable media, you should have some sort of security on, whether it's a firewall or antivirus. That includes your phone. You know, that antivirus really doesn't exist for most phones out there, but you can write to the drive on the phone. So it's possible that hackers can write to your phone also. So it's something that you want to be aware of. And yeah, I don't know. I think jailbreakers are always going to be out there. It's just they're going to be one step behind. You know, like this guy obviously got hired by Apple because he wants to actually make money. I mean, there can't be that much money in the jailbreak market with nobody hiring you. So we'll see what happens. Maybe the next version of iOS will be a more decent product, because the dude who knows how to hack it will be making it better. We don't know. We'll see. But now here is something that is very interesting for those people who don't buy iPhones or Macs in general because they like keyboards. I should just say iPhones. Macs have keyboards. The people who don't buy iPhones because they want a tactile keyboard. They want real buttons. Unfortunately, in the future, if all goes well with Apple's patent, their keyboards for their computers are also going to be touchscreen. Have you taken a look at this patent? Like, what do you...
I looked at it briefly when I, you know, reviewed the article. I mean,
I know you like buttons. You have a BlackBerry because it has buttons. Like,
yeah.
What would you think if this patent, you know, gets accepted and all Macs don't come with real button keyboards anymore? They're just like iPads for the keyboard. Because that's pretty much what this is going to be, touchscreen keyboard.
I mean, if there's a real world, like, you know, if they can prove to me that this makes, you know, and show me how it makes my typing more efficient, you know, I'd consider it. Like, if you look at Star Trek, you know, they typed on glass panels.
Yeah.
Good luck getting a patent on that. Well, they could definitely patent the process with which it happens. It's more of like a mechanical thing, but the idea definitely isn't patentable on its own.
Yeah, Star Trek will be suing them.
but
what do you think in terms of? I mean, you have a tablet now. Mm-hmm. Have you actually used the on-screen keyboard, or have you only used the docked keyboard so far?
I mean, I've used the on-screen keyboard when I disconnect it and just carry it around and sit on the couch or whatever. It works. You know, you can definitely type input. I actually think in some ways that even though this keyboard is bigger on a tablet, it's less useful because you have to like cover more distance with your finger to, you know, because you're sort of holding it with one hand and like maybe tapping out with like two fingers and your thumb or something. And you have to move around the screen a lot, where on a phone, it's like, at least it's all like, it's real small movements.
It's within a finger swipe distance.
Yeah, exactly. So that part I don't like very much. In terms of like how it reacts to my typing, it's good. I definitely think it's really good at detecting where I'm typing. I do think that a keyboard without keys may work. The problem that I notice the most about typing on a glass display is that I don't know where home is.
Very true.
But if there were some indicators, like, you know, they put the two little like braille bump things on the home row. If there were those, or even some more indicators of like where the enter key might be, like maybe a,
right.
They could put, I could imagine, you know, the two bumps for the home key, maybe on the left, there's a vertical line for where the end of A is. So where your tab key is, and then another line that's horizontal below that to show you where like the shift key is. And then on the other side, sort of the same thing, one for the enter key, another vertical line, and another horizontal line for another shift key, sort of help you like locate yourself on it so you don't have to look at it.
How would that work though? Because you can also get a keyboard in the vertical portrait mode. Are you going to have bumps all around the sides?
But I think we're talking about a device that's like just a keyboard, right?
Oh, so I was assuming you were still talking about your tablet.
Oh, no, I meant this keyboard. I'm sorry.
Yeah, okay.
On a tablet, it really wouldn't make a lot of sense. Right. You're right. Yeah, that wouldn't make sense at all. But as if it was a hardware keyboard that had this technology built into it, I could see them using some tactile, you know, not even like feedback, just tactile features
yeah.
You know, that are on there. It would definitely help.
Yeah, I mean, as far as, because I type on my iPad a lot. And I'll normally set it flat on my lap so that I can type with both hands. And I find that it is really good. Like, I am almost as fast on that as I am on a real keyboard. My problem is that I'm too fast. You know, I can type so fast that the screen on the iPad can't keep up. And sometimes it just misses stuff that I type.
Mm-hmm.
So if they can get response time down, like that's going to be a big problem if they want this to be a real keyboard on regular desktop computers, is that you have really fast typers out there.
Yeah.
And you're going to need this thing to respond so fast. And part of the problem is that it's also processing in the background to do the auto correction.
Mm-hmm.
Since there aren't real keys, you know, it's trying to fix your words as you type because you might miss one. So it has to have that fast enough too.
Yeah. I mean, there definitely is latency problems in. And I think I'm sure, you know, I've been a tactile keyboard guy, you know, real hardware keyboard guy on all devices, at least as an option, almost, you know, like if it's a slider or an attachment or something, to get real work, what I call real work done. You know, like when you want to tap out an email,
right.
You just don't want to do it on an on-screen keyboard, especially if it's more than like a sentence. You know, for Twitter, fine.
Right.
For text messages, okay. For carrying on a conversation, for writing out a lengthy email or a letter or something else, it's just not useful. And maybe, hey, you just switch to your desktop for that. But I think even in the desktop world, you know, we've seen a wide variety of the quality keyboards made, and also in laptops. You know, I've used some laptops that are just like, literally I can't type on them, and other ones, you know, there's chiclet keyboards, there's flat keyed keyboards, there's ones that have slight, you know, scallop to them. There's all types of keyboards, and the one that I can still type the fastest on is an IBM Type M. I mean, those things are just like, you know, it's that buckling spring technology.
Right, the clicky keyboard.
Yeah, it has, you know, it was patented. It's the only, it's current, as far as I know, it's the only technology that guarantees, like, when you feel that click, there is an actual contact being made, where everything else is a rubber or plastic like device that gives you that click feel, but isn't actually doing the action.
The clicking. Yeah.
Yeah, the clicking is done by some other electronic thing inside.
Right.
So the, you know, there's advantages to them, and there's, I can type so much faster on them. So.
Yeah, I actually found a keyboard that I really like. It's the Microsoft 4000 Elite or something. It's a natural keyboard. I like it so much, I bought a couple of them so that whenever they break, I could just replace it with another one. Like,
yeah, there's actually a company right now that sells the Type M remakes. They're
nice.
They're made with the same, from the same parts. They're not made by IBM or anything, but
right. Yeah, Dell actually for the longest time sent out those type of keyboards. They probably licensed it from IBM.
Yeah,
but the real clicky keyboards.
Yeah.
Those are nice.
Yeah, I like Keytronics makes a nice one too. That's not a buckling spring technology, but it has a good feel. And I can definitely tell I can type faster on certain keyboards, notably related to the space bar and enter buttons. Like those can really, if they're not positioned right, or there's just like some of them you hit them from the side and they're slower.
And they don't go down.
Yeah.
I
yeah.
Hate
there's,
that.
There's a difference. And I mean, maybe this for people that aren't on a computer 24/7. Or even 8 hours a day at work, there's a big difference. So,
and while we're talking about a new technology, it also turns out that Apple might be working on a television. Now, we're not talking about Apple TV, not a little box that you connect to your television. We're talking about an Apple-branded television. You know, 46-inch, 48-inch, whatever it might be, but an actual TV that Apple sells that apparently is going to run the same thing that the Apple TV set-top box also ran. So the picture on the article here from MediaBeat, looks like a subsidiary of VentureBeat, looks like an iPad. You know, it's iOS, which is, I mean, that's all you really need. You're not going to be touching your TV. But since we don't really know, this is just a rumor, Let's talk about what we might want in an Apple TV. For me, I don't want to be touching my TV. This better not be a touchscreen.
Yeah, I don't see. I mean, I kind of call this the Bill Gates used to call it the 10-foot interface.
Yeah, the lean back interface.
Yeah, there's different names.
Yeah,
for
there's
it.
The lean forward and the sit back. So it's a sit back maybe.
Yeah, sit back.
Yeah.
One, it has to be really usable from a remote. I don't want to touch a touchpad. Like, and I have some experience with this. I have a home theater PC. It has Windows Vista, I think, on it. Doesn't matter because I don't use the operating system. And then, you know, I've used Media Center on it a little, and it also has Sage TV, which they recently got bought by Google. And it, you know, there's a remote for it, and you can also use a mouse and a keyboard. Even when you have a keyboard that works from that distance and is flawless and, you know, a mouse and everything, it's just not what the way you want to use it. When you need to fix something on it or install an update or whatever, yeah, you need that, you know, for like maintenance type things, which you shouldn't really even need for a set-top box. But when it comes down to it, the remote is like the primary interface. It's got to work well with the remote. And it can't be some remote that, like, I've used these Apple remotes. They're terrible. That's something they're terrible at. They look nice. They're like sleek.
They do look nice. Yeah.
You know, but I have remotes that, like, I have to say, like, even the Comcast remote, it's got a ton of buttons on it, and sometimes it's hard to use, but it's comfortable in your hand. You know, like you and I have a couple other remotes, like the Sony ones are never that great. The Vizio remote for my TV, that one has a real nice, and I think the kind of the standard navigation on a TV is a four-way rocker, like a D-pad basically,
right,
with a center button that selects and maybe an exit button or something.
Or like your guide button or your other buttons around it.
They need to come up with, they need to have some kind of sort of standardized interface there, and it's got to be comfortable in your hand. I'd say if they can't do that, forget it. Like, it's not, no one's going to, like, you may get people to buy it, but it's not going to be like the widespread.
Well, here's the thing that, I mean, this is my bet. You know, when this thing comes out, this is what I think they're going to do, is that this is going to be a product for people who own iPads and iPhones, because that is going to be your remote. There's going to be an app you install. This TV is obviously going to have Wi-Fi. I mean, they're not going to ship a TV that doesn't have Wi-Fi. All new TVs now are smart, quote-unquote, smart TVs. So it's going to have Wi-Fi, and in order to use it, you're going to need an iPhone or an iPad connected to the same Wi-Fi network, and you're going to have an app on there that is the remote.
That's very possible. I mean, you know, you could just use the remote to navigate through your music or movies or TV or whatever, and then just click on it and it plays.
Right.
But that almost completely negates the need for any interface on the TV. If you think about it.
Yeah, if you could just look at the iPad or iPhone.
Yeah, the TV just needs to basically play.
Display content.
Display content. The problem I see with that solution, and maybe that's a little extreme, is, you know, if you lose the iPhone, it's like, how do you shut this TV off? How do you stop it? You know?
Yeah, there still needs to be buttons.
Yeah, maybe it has a backup, some backup buttons on the screen or something, or it does have like a touch interface, but I don't know. I mean, I don't know why Apple would get into the TV business. I really don't. Like,
well, why would they get into the phone business? You know, that's what everybody thought back when they got into the iPhone, and it turned out to be a big success. Maybe this is one of those things that we just can't see now.
I don't know. I don't think people were surprised about the iPhone. They kind of expected it. And
really?
Well, I mean, like, you have to remember, Apple had the Newton years ago, so they were like one of the first into the personal digital assistant market.
Right.
I don't know if they were the first, but they were in there early. Microsoft had tons of success with their PDAs early on. I mean, you know, right now they're fizzled to something like 5% market share in the U.S., but, you know, prior to the iPhone, they like, you know, as everyone like makes fun of Microsoft, but Microsoft did what they sought out to do, and that was to kill Palm. You have to remember, you know, turn back the clock to 2001, 2002. Palm was on top, maybe even a little before that.
Palm Trios.
Yeah, Palm Trios and
Palm 7. What is it? 700? I don't know what the original ones were. The gray screen ones.
Yeah, there was. Wasn't there like a visor or something?
That sounds familiar.
There, you know, there was all kinds of Palms out there.
Yeah.
All different ones. And Microsoft saw that and they said, well, we're gonna go after that market. And they did, and they cleaned their clock. As evidenced the fact that they were bought by HP, and we'll talk about that later, I think. But, you know, getting back to the TV, I don't think people actually expect to make a TV, and I think it's a bad move, and here's why I think it's a bad move. People replace their TVs every 10 years, 5 to 10 years. People replace the rest of their electronics 2 to 3 years. Or sometimes sooner, 1 year. Seems like some of these cycles are
good. Yeah, really.
So I don't know how you make a device like this, make it upgradable over 5 to 10 years, make it relevant in 10 years. I mean, look at TVs from 10 years ago compared to now.
Yeah, really.
I mean, granted, this has been like one of the bigger like revolutionary changes in television, but you know, with HDTV and whatnot.
I do see your point, though.
I don't know. The set, they're like Apple TV boxes aren't even selling that well.
Although, you know, this might be one of Apple's moves to make you spend money, because whenever they came out with their iPhone, the trend was you didn't pay for phones. You got phones for free with your contract. And they came out with something that was so much better, people threw down $300, $400 every year to get a new one. Do you think they could do that with a TV and make people spend money every 2 years?
I don't. And here's, this is something I was talking with a friend. Apple has had great success in the smartphone and now the tablet market, mainly because there wasn't, like, for what they were doing with it comparatively, there wasn't any competition. But now Google is cleaning their clock in the smartphone market. Google's now 43% of the worldwide smartphone market.
I'm not going to disagree with a number. I'm going to disagree on how they got to that number. Every phone out there runs Android, whether it's a smartphone or not.
Yeah, but we're talking about actual activations and use,
activations of crappy half smartphones that just happen to run Android. Like, that's a big chunk of the
numbers. If it runs Android, it's a smartphone. I mean, it's going to there's no difference in one Android phone to the other in terms of what it can do.
Have you seen some of these phones? They're like dumb phones, but they happen to run Android, like Verizon crap phones. Like, that's a big chunk of the activations.
I don't know how many of the.
Either way, keep on with your point.
So, I mean, it's a big part of the market segment. In the U.S., it's in the 40s. I don't know if it's quite as high as it is worldwide, but it's pretty high. And, you know, I guess my point with Apple and this TV market is, you know, they do have to continue to sell the hardware. And if they don't sell it, they can't get people into what makes them the money. And the hardware doesn't make, I mean, they make profit on the hardware, I'm sure. But the money is in the apps, and right. It's in the books and the movies and the music. So you have, like, for Apple's model to work, they have to get you in to their environment, like hardware wise. The only place they've ever made a little concession on that is with iTunes on the PC, because the PC market was so big. Now, granted, you still had to buy an iPod, but you could just download iTunes and buy music too without an iPod. If you just wanted to listen to music on your PC.
Right. You could just use it as a player.
Right. And then once the DRM went away, you could really use any player you wanted. Yep. Now you can use whatever player. So that's about the only place I've seen them make a concession where we're going to sell you software without hardware.
But do you think that just wasn't a way to draw people into their ecosystem? They see this, I'm going to use the word, awesome media player that you can now have on Windows that works awesome with Apple products. They see Apple on both products and they're like, oh, maybe I should buy an Apple computer too. Do you think that just wasn't a way to kind of draw people into their ecosystem, not really a concession?
No, I don't think that it was a way to draw people into their market, because their market share hasn't increased all that much in the desktop. It's laptops.
Right.
It's gone up, definitely. I think it's gone from in terms of new PC sales, it's definitely a little higher. High-end PCs, yeah, they have the market. But, you know, it's almost like they don't even offer no one even makes high-end PCs. You know, like it's right. Everything's like $1,000 or less. Not really, but.
No, I know what you mean.
You know, that's just kind of how the PC market is. And, But overall market share for desktop computers, you know, cumulative of what's being used out there today, they're still in like the neighborhood of like 10%. They definitely have increased, but I'd say most of that increase is not, I don't know how, I mean, there maybe there's more people that have switched from Mac to PC than I know of, but I think really it's just, they're sort of like expanding. Like they're, you know, they've taken some users that maybe would have never gotten a computer or are just now getting a computer because they have the iPod.
Right. So it's not necessarily they're drawing people away from PC.
Yeah. I don't know that that's the case. Not in droves. I mean,
right. Right.
I mean, they definitely have a bias in them. I mean, I don't want to call it a bias. Maybe it's not a bias. Maybe people just think they're better, but, you know, in tech media, it seems to be like all Apple. And I don't understand it.
Like, you have to use one, dude.
I have used them. I'm not oblivious to the way Macs work. And I think that they're just really good at selling the whole, like, you know, ecosystem to people. But getting back to the point, I think that a TV is something that you have to, like, you're really in for the long haul with a TV. And if they can't sell the TVs, what's their model? Like, the Apple TV makes sense to me, the desktop thing.
Yeah.
Which I hate that they changed it to Apple TV, the iTV, I like that name better. That, you know, because that's in the sort of connotates a device or something.
Right.
But anyway, that little hockey puck box thing they sell, that makes sense because it's like cheap, inexpensive hardware, gets you into our model. An Apple TV is going to be a big, expensive piece of hardware. They're not going to make a crappy TV.
It's going to be minimum $3,000.
Yeah, it's going to be a backlit LED, 240 hertz, blah, blah, blah,
it's
blah,
gonna
blah.
It's going to be like 480 hertz.
Yeah, it's going to be whatever the latest and greatest is. It probably won't make a whole lot of difference, you know, in image quality.
I bet it's going to be 3D, non-glasses 3D. I bet Apple's going to come out with that.
But I don't care. They could make it have a popcorn maker on it, and it's not going to get people to spend $3,000 on a TV. Not when you can go to Best Buy, slap down $700 and get yourself a 46-inch TV.
Yeah.
You know, that has LED backlights or even a fluorescent backlight, and it's going to last 10 years.
My TV right now is a LCD fluorescent backlight. It's nothing special, but I'm not getting rid of it anytime soon.
Yeah, it's just like 1080 is as good as it gets for broadcast material. Blu-ray is dead in the water as far as I'm concerned.
Dude, there is no other medium.
What's that?
There is no other medium for high-def content. Streaming does not do it.
Oh, but it will. I mean, Blu-ray acceptance isn't even close to what DVD was.
Oh, I don't care about acceptance. I care about quality, and you can't get that on streaming.
Yeah, but give it a couple years. I mean, the bandwidth and
but that's what you're assuming is bandwidth. Like, you need Was it Comcast that said it's like 6 or 8 megabits minimum for what they call a high def 720p stream?
Yeah,
I don't have that. A lot of people don't have that.
Well. Right. I mean, I still think broadcast delivers a pretty good HD experience. I think it's decent.
It's fine. Artifacts. Pixelates a lot. Yeah.
It does. Especially with like bright lights and stuff that change. But I'm just saying, like, what I mean is, like, there's not going to be another. Blu-ray is the last media.
You think they're moving away from hard, tangible media?
It's done. There's Blu-ray sales, players, and discs. Are nowhere near what DVD was. Like, they haven't even, it's just not even close. I mean, actually, maybe I should step back. I haven't checked it in a while, but I followed Blu-ray really closely for a while, and it got to the point where, I mean, I own probably 300 DVDs. You know how many Blu-rays I own? Two. I own
my
two
whole
Blu-rays.
Wall is Blu-rays.
I'm
probably the edge case.
Part of the reason I haven't invested in them is because I don't watch the DVDs that I bought. Like, you know, this whole idea of owning a home library was kind of cool, but now I'm like, well, eventually you can be able to stream it all, so I don't even really care. It's like, I'd rather have, like, you know, instant access on any device versus, like, sitting up my TV and watching it.
I'm trying to find an article real quick that has the numbers, but I'm not finding anything useful.
Yeah, I think the industry just wants to hide the fact that...
Yeah, Google's hiding everything. So anyways, We're going to go a little bit out of order here. We have one last article that talks about Apple. Ryan, this was something that you submitted, talking about Line and a bug.
Yeah, so Apple released OS X Line, 10.7?
Yeah.
I think it is, like a couple months ago. Or
it was just a couple weeks ago.
Yeah. Turns out there's a bug in their open LDAP protocol, and LDAP is Light Directory Access Protocol. Right?
Lightweight
directory.
Yeah.
And LDAP's basically what, you know, corporate networks use to authenticate machines to, is it to a Windows network? Or just really any network?
LDAP is an open standard. Active Directory implements LDAP for the Windows use.
Right. Okay. So, but if you have a Mac and you hook it up to a server and, like, you know, sort of provision it on a corporate network, well, it's got a bug in LDAP in 10.7 where once you log in one time, after that, it will accept any username and password from thenceforth to access any resource that it needs to be authenticated for. So I think the resource you're accessing, you may still have to have access to, like access rights, but if it prompts you again or you have to re-enter your credentials or anything like that, or any further logins, it just allows them.
Yeah, I don't know what the exact problem is. From what I read in the thread, it seems like you needed a correct username, but you could enter in junk for the password.
Right, and I think that's only on the first time. Okay. After that, it might accept anything. The worst part is they knew about the bug. They were advised of the bug. They didn't fix it in 10.7.1, which I think just came out maybe a day or two ago.
If so, I'm checking my Mac right now to see if I have it, because I don't think I do.
Then maybe it hasn't been released yet.
I have 10.7.
It's on its way out. It's not going to be fixed in 10.7.1. And I was just like, that's a pretty freaking big bug. Like, if you can't do logins right, I mean, what's going on?
And I mean, this is one of many, but it's widely known that Macs on a corporate network are easier to hack. Just because the way that Macs were brought up, the way they were born, the way they've matured over the year, they were never a corporate thing like Windows were. So yeah, there's a lot of bugs like this, and this is just one of the newest ones that you think they would have caught.
Yeah, like, but you know, the other thing I wanted to bring up in relation to this is I read an anecdote again related to Steve Jobs' resignation, and it was somebody that worked at Apple, and they had gotten into some meeting with Steve. It was like I think it was something they do occasionally on the Apple campus where they like sort of have a presentation by some of the executives or something. I'm not sure. And they had a question and answer session, and he got called upon, and he asked Steve two questions. And I don't remember the first one, his questions weren't the important part. Somebody else asked the question about Enterprise, and Steve basically answered, if you came to work on Enterprise, you're probably at the wrong company. And I mean, I don't know if that's 100% true or accurate. It sounds like him. But here's the thing. Apple is never, never going to be number one overall unless they embrace the corporate market, the enterprise market. They will never be number one.
Well, I mean, seriously, where do all the big purchases come from? You have million-dollar contracts that are just like, go spend $500K on computers now.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's where the big money comes from.
It is. And I just think that, you know, I'm say this in the nicest possible way. They need to get their act together on the enterprise stuff for the sole reason that they sell this crap to, you know, graphic artists and whatever else. And
people who work in enterprises.
Yeah. And these people have to interact with the rest of the company. They, you know, they have to be able to share documents and stuff. Otherwise, they're going to be using USB keys to transfer data from the corporate network to, and even that's not allowed in a lot of places now.
Right.
So, you know, something's got to be done about this. You cannot have these kind of holes if they're going to be allowed to be part of an enterprise network. You know, and I guess it's not that big of a deal. You know, administrators are just going to screen out the OS that has the bugs and say, well, you can't install 10.7 until these are fixed, and then we'll reconsider it. But nonetheless,
this is still something that should not have made it.
Not have made it to release.
Yeah.
Not have made it. If this happened in Windows, could you imagine?
Dude.
Could you imagine? I mean, it would be like scandal from... there'd be no end to it.
Companies would shut down. Microsoft would be sued. Cats and dogs living together.
Mm-hmm. It'd be crazy.
Anybody catch the movie quote there? No? Nobody?
Not me.
Ghostbusters.
Oh. That Bill Murray, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think
cats and dogs living together. So, next two articles, I don't really want to talk about these that much unless you have something a lot to say, but just, you know, quick impressions. Switch the focus to Microsoft for a second. I believe we had talked before about the next version of, you know, Windows being more JavaScript and HTML than real code. Now they're doing the same thing with Office.
Than real code, I like that.
Yeah, because HTML and JavaScript are not real code. They're in...
Well, one's a markup language. The other one is, I guess, interpreted.
Yeah, whatever. But now they're doing the same thing for Office. My personal opinion, bad idea. Your opinion?
I don't know. Here's what I'm not a Java developer. I'm not a JavaScript developer. I'm not a Java developer. I'm not an HTML5 developer. I'm not into really any of the web technologies. Not necessarily that Java is really a web technology, but JavaScript definitely is. But Microsoft has not embraced any of these technologies very tightly for years. I think they should, for the sole reason that they make the absolutely best programming tools known to man. I firmly believe that...
No, I totally agree with you.
I firmly believe that that Visual Studio is better in every way than every other IDE I've touched.
Love Visual Studio.
Yeah. And that, I don't know if they can really make money at that, because it's something that it's a high dollar thing. Like, you pay a lot of money for it.
I just got it for free.
Well, you can get academic license. Yeah. but my point is, you know, that I welcome them embracing this if they give me better tools to interface with these technologies so I don't have to use the other awful alternatives.
But here's the thing, though. We're talking about Microsoft Office. Essentially, what they're doing is they're putting it in a web browser. if you're writing a Word document or an Excel spreadsheet or doing a Microsoft project plan, do you want to be doing this in a web browser that is going to be slow and interpreted? Like, really, don't you want real applications for this?
Well, I think at some point it doesn't matter. The hardware is so fast now that it just doesn't matter. Like, you can render this stuff so well. And, you know, like, just for example, like, any code that runs on, like, you know, a virtual machine type environment and like, a common language, like, with C#.
Like Java or .NET stuff.
Yeah, it doesn't matter how it runs. I mean, I'm not saying this really isn't the same thing as JavaScript and HTML5, but I just think that it could be done, and it could be done well.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what they do with this, because it's not out yet.
It makes sense to me because Windows 8 is going to, they say it's going to be JavaScript and HTML5.
Right, the new interface is,
yeah,
whatever that they're calling that. So our next article from Hot Hardware, another quick one. Comcast is launching a $10 Internet Essentials broadband for low-income families. So to qualify, you have to make $25,000 or less in a year. You have to have children in school in elementary or high school. You don't have any overdue Comcast bills, and you haven't had Comcast internet paying more within the last 90 days. Do you think this is good or bad?
I'm all for opening up access to the internet. I'm getting to the point where I think that the internet is critical enough, it needs to be almost like a utility.
I totally agree.
It's almost like roads. You know, it's something that I think they could just invest in, that really the infrastructure isn't all that much of an expense. I don't know. I mean, I'd love to know what the backbone network infrastructure for the internet costs. Like,
How do we find out those numbers? Really?
I don't know. I don't think it's in the trillions. I think it's probably in tens of billions of dollars. I think it's something that would be much better spent on in providing broadband for everyone everywhere. It would make devices much more useful to have Wi-Fi everywhere, you know, not having to hunt for a Wi-Fi network.
Right.
Yeah,
I totally agree with you. However, I wish that they wouldn't have these restrictions. Why not have a $10 internet for anybody who wants the $10 internet?
Well,
make it a little slower, you know, so... But why would you not just offer this to everybody?
I guess the point there, though, is that, you know, this is sort of an assistance sort of program where it's
like
not,
food stamps for internet.
Yeah, like it's like almost saying like, oh, you get lower quality food because you pay less for it. They do pay less for it, but it's like it's not really assistance then.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, I see what you mean there. Okay, so that makes
sense.
That's
kind of it's hard to
comment. But either way, I think we both agree this is not a bad thing.
It's not terrible.
No. Our next article is actually something you sent me from the Wall Street Journal, talking about Hewlett Packard. What are they doing?
What aren't they doing? aren't they doing wrong?
What aren't they doing anymore?
Yeah. So everybody, we mentioned about WebOS, right?
Yeah. They got rid of it.
Yeah, or Palm, I guess, was really what I mentioned.
Yeah.
Palm, you know, they came out with this new OS called WebOS. They launched it on the Palm Pre. It did okay. It wasn't super successful.
Yeah.
It gained a little bit of a following. Got a lot of good reviews in terms of like the interface, revolutionary type of interface that it was. It's all web based, yada yada. Well, HP saw some value in the product. They bought Palm.
Or did they see the value?
Yeah, and they decided to push WebOS onto all of the devices that they made. They stated that PCs would eventually have WebOS as an alternative operating system. And now they're saying that they're basically going to possibly get out of the computer manufacturing business, the PC side of it, not the server side, and get out of making WebOS tablets and devices.
HP drops the mic, I'm out.
Yeah. I don't understand this at all. And I just noticed that apparently the Wall Street Journal has now said that I have to pay for this article.
Really? It opened right up for me.
That's interesting. Oh, no, no. I'm sorry. Subscriber content preview. It had a lock on it, though. Or, well, it's a key. Okay. Never mind.
You just have a preview of the article?
Huh? No, I see it full now.
Oh, okay.
I read it wrong.
Oh, okay. Because I have seen sites that, like, New York Times, you know, won't let you get to certain things.
Well, I mean, Wall Street Journal does it a lot, but sometimes they give you this preview mode. They're like, oh, you can preview it.
Freaking paywall.
Yeah. But anyway, the interesting thing is that, you know, HP is the number one PC manufacturer in the world. They, you know, combined forces with Compaq, who had previously combined forces with DEC, into this super corporation that makes pretty much, you know, a large portion of, like, 40%, something like that?
It's a lot.
They're
a supernopoly.
They're a heavyweight in the PC industry. They make a lot of servers. They also provide services, like, and software development and all that sort of stuff, like IT management and whatever. And what really doesn't make sense to me is that them selling off the computer business, their profits aren't that great on it, but it feeds all of their other industries.
Well, let's put this into perspective real quick. If you scroll down to almost the bottom of that article, there's a little chart there. Other things that HP does, $1.03 billion. Printer market, $6 billion. Server market, $5.5 billion. Services, $9 billion. PCs, $9.5 billion. PCs and servers are their two biggest segments. They're almost equal.
Yeah,
they're getting rid of half of their... Like, what are they doing?
They have this split out, you know, such that it looks like PCs... They're still the biggest, but, like, it's... They've got these other market segments that make up more. But really, like, servers, PCs, and printers, those kind of all go together.
They do.
People that buy PCs buy printers. People that buy servers are going to buy PCs for their network.
To use the servers.
And they're going to use printers as well. Like, the thing that doesn't make sense in there are the services. Like, that's the one...
Well, people who buy servers, depending on which class of servers, buy their services to have them come in and set them up.
Yeah, well, that's true. But that's... I guess that's something you could easily outsource. You could outsource all of it, I guess, because it's all, you know, intercompatible with other brands.
Right.
But it just surprises me because they could probably get a lot more integration between all the products should benefit from that. You know, the fact that their servers and PCs and printers are all made by the same people, you know. You sell off the PCs and now you've got to attach all these PCs from another maker to your server, which in the world of Windows isn't a huge challenge, but it's still, you know, there's still something there.
You still would like the quote unquote Apple model where you control the infrastructure.
Yeah. You know, there's still something about it, I think, that just doesn't jive for me. Like, and servers and PCs are so similar, especially nowadays. Like, this might have made sense, you know, if you were HP or IBM, even. Like IBM, it made a lot of sense because IBM servers were never really Windows servers. They mostly were into, like, mainframe.
They were like AIX.
Yeah, they were heavily into Unix and other mainframe technologies. I'm sure they sold a few Windows servers, but you know, over the years, Windows has totally taken over the server market, and now they're like the same. They use the same parts almost. I mean, yeah, the servers use ECC RAM and they use Xeon processors, but it's coming from the same suppliers. They're coming from Micron and Samsung and Intel and you know, the Taiwanese motherboard manufacturers. It's all the same people. I don't understand. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, I have no idea what they're thinking. Did they do this because they think they can make more money getting rid of it? Are they spinning off a company that they're still going to own under, like, an umbrella corporate? What are they doing?
Yeah. Well, and here's my thing. Like, they've said that I've heard the rumor that HP has to sell 7 PCs or 8. I'm not sure the exact number. 7 or 8 PCs to make the same profit that Apple makes on one of their PCs. Now, I don't know if that includes laptops and desktops or just desktops or what, but... That says something. That says that Apple has, you know, commands a pretty big profit on their machines.
Right.
And I don't understand why, you know, they need to make... And then here's the other thing is I don't know... if that means that that's after expenses or if it's like money made on the hardware. Like, you know, here's what it cost.
Like the at cost
to
numbers.
Manufacture it. Yeah, there's, you know, yeah. Exactly. Because does that include R&D and all the engineering? Because I'm sure Apple spends more. But if it does include all the engineering and R&D, then that tells me that Apple's commanding a price premium that's really just unwarranted, you know? And it also says that there's room in the market in PCs to make a more expensive PC that is like high quality. You know, make me a PC out of metal, like the MacBook, and I'll buy it.
Right. Don't give me this plastic junk that everybody uses.
Right. I mean, some are better than others. You know, acrylic, actually, some of the acrylics are pretty cool and in some ways better than metal. But I still think that they need to make a PC that's like the hardware is a little bit better quality. I have no problem with the software. I think Windows 7 is actually a better operating system. I think that Microsoft has shown taken great strides in the innovation of the UIs, especially with Windows 8 and the Metro UI. I think they're doing the most research when it comes to like human machine interface, other than maybe the tactile parts of it. You know, that's a little different in terms of like touch versus.
Right.
But they still do a lot of touch research. That said, the problem I have with the PC market right now is the quality of the hardware. It's not there unless you build it yourself or you buy something from like some, you know, weird company that you've never heard of.
Yeah, and I don't even recommend people build their own computers anymore just because you don't have that warranty. I mean, I ran into this. I built my own computer to go to college with. And second semester of college, my crap broke and I couldn't do a paper that I needed to do for class. Like,
yeah.
There was no warranty. I couldn't send it back and have them fix it. I couldn't have anybody come to my room and fix it. Like,
yeah.
I buy pre-made computers now because I want somebody to fix it when it breaks.
Yeah. I mean, my laptops are pre-made. It's pretty much any way you can buy
them. Yeah.
But, you know, I still do build my PCs. I don't think that's ever going to change, except like in the case, I have been thinking about getting an all-in-one just to like sit in the kitchen.
Right.
And that's something you can't really build.
Yeah. If you can, I haven't seen it.
Yeah. But anyway, crazy HP.
Yes.
There's another article in the Wall Street Journal actually came out like a day or two ago. It was a couple days after this one. I recommend it if you search for it. It basically talks about how to kill a company, like how a company commits suicide. And it basically chronicles everything HP's done in the last year or two. And I have to say, shame on you, HP. I mean, maybe they'll come out of this unscathed and they'll be stronger. But it's just like, what do you do if you don't make PCs anymore?
Yeah, that's what everybody knows them for.
Yeah. I think even like IBM, like I was really pissed when IBM spun off Lenovo. I'm like, you just sold the PC industry out.
Yep.
You know, and it's not that they're not making money on it. They are. They just don't think the margin's good enough. It's like, well, some industries you're not going to be. Why not expand? Why sell a segment that's profitable?
Why not become the manufacturer that makes the good, slightly more expensive PCs?
Yeah, or, you know, maybe open up just a division that does that. There's a million things they could do. And then they sell off this webOS idea. Like, if anybody could have made it successful, I think HP could have. They could have pushed it. But now they're saying, oh, we're going to, like, support it on our devices. Get real. No wonder you got rid of your PC industry, the PC industry, because now you're competing with Microsoft.
They got the wrong people driving the ship.
Yeah, they could have collaborated with Microsoft with the webOS thing, and that may have been the Microsoft's mobile. You know, they could have done a million things, and they just didn't do it. And I think they're heading down the tubes.
So you should not take stock advice from me, but if I were to give stock advice, sell all your HP stock because it's tanking real soon.
Yeah, I mean, it pains me. It pains me to see. I've never been a huge HP fan, but I still have a lot of respect for the company over the years, and I just can't believe it.
Yeah. So we were talking about your tablet earlier, and you submitted an article from Engadget kind of saying, tablets.
Yeah. So I actually saw this article a couple days before I finally pulled the trigger on a tablet.
That's kind of funny.
It is, because when you read this article, you know, it really talks about why, you know, tablets aren't as great as everyone makes them out to be. And I agree with a lot of what the article has to say. You know, they're awkward to use. They are. Like, if you're in anything other than like a sitting position, they're awkward. Like, to hold one, you know, while you're standing, you, like, can't set it anywhere if you need to do something with your other hand. You can't use both hands to type when you're standing with it. You know, it's got to be sort of like touch. It's like it's one hand holds, one hand touches.
Yeah, if you're leaning on your couch, you don't have a stand. Like, none of the cases that fold into stands fold in such a way that if you're laying on a couch or leaning on something that you can also see it. Like, it's just weird.
If you're laying in bed, you're like holding it over your head, which has always been a problem with books, but books weighed like a half pound. Yeah. Tablets weigh like a pound and
then
a half.
You fall asleep and it smashes you in the face.
Yeah. I mean, I don't see a lot of, they're big for like music playback. They're kind of big, you know, they like an iPod, you can like sit it next to you on your pillow and they're kind of like, you know, iPod, the older iPods are like almost indestructible. You know, you can just like, if they fell off your bed, you wouldn't really care.
Right.
Or whatever. You set it on your nightstand, you have your headphones in. Tablets are like, they're kind of big. They take up a lot of space. There's just, you know, and then it's like being productive on one. Like, can you really like produce on one? Can you make things? And they haven't, I think maybe some of it's the software hasn't got there yet on the productivity side.
Well, there definitely needs to be more integration. You know, people do use things. Crap, just dropped my bottle cap. People do use things like a, you know, Dropbox, which integrates with some apps to save your storage in the, or save your files in the cloud because there's no storage and blah, blah, blah. But they're really just hacks. You know, there is no real integrated way of doing, being productive.
So I think that they have a hill to climb. But that said, the funny thing about this article was I had heard about the Asus Transformer before this, but I saw the picture here in the article where it showed the Asus Transformer.
I was just
going to
say, hey, you have that.
And it was something I had been looking at because I knew, like, but my main feature with the Asus was it's one of the only Android tablets that has an IPS display, which is the high quality LED backlit display that the iPad has. So I wanted an IPS display. So that's what got me looking at the Asus. But then I saw this picture. I'm like, oh, there's a cool keyboard dock. And someone had told me about it, but I hadn't actually looked into it. And I started looking into it more and more, and I'm like, man, I think this is really the tablet for me that I would go with. And the more I looked into it, I liked the fact that it was a netbook convertible, is why they call it the Transformer. So I like Asus's take on the tablet. You get a useful little tablet or netbook that then pops apart, and you have a tablet. I mean, on the tablet side, you can't tell it apart from like an Acer Iconia or a Zoom. It's a little thicker than a Zoom, slightly thicker. Slightly thicker than like a Samsung Tab.
But it's still small. Like
No thicker than the original iPad, I don't think.
No, it looks exactly like the original iPad.
In terms of the bevel and it's got a square edge with a slight bevel on it. You know, so it's definitely there on that aspect. And then you just add all the extra functionality. In addition, the cool thing about the keyboard is you get two USB ports, which have their Type A connectors.
That actually surprised me.
Yeah. Like, I don't know if most people don't realize this, but you can't add storage to a tablet usually, even if it has a USB port, because it's a Type B port, which can't host.
You need a USB host.
Right. They could hack it a little bit, I think. There might be a host inside and they could hack the software to get it to work, but generally out of the box, it won't work. This will actually attach to storage.
Yeah, plug in a thumb drive.
Or an external. I think an external hard drive would even work. I haven't tried it yet. It also has a full-size media reader and an additional battery in the keyboard, so you get more battery life. So overall, I think it's a better product, a better concept than some of the other tablets. So that's what sort of sealed it for me in the face of this article. But even at that, tablets are still cool. I mean, they still
they fill a niche, like we said earlier.
Yeah, there's a novelty to them too, and it may wear off. But they are nice to just sit back on the couch and read some web pages.
Yeah, I don't think they're going away like a lot of people say they are. I mean, they do fill a need.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was a need that nobody knew was there at first because everybody had a laptop. But now that you don't, you know, you have an instant-on tablet that can do 98% of the things that your laptop can do,
mm-hmm.
there was a need there that people just didn't know about. So, you know, like I said earlier, I'll be interested to see what you think of it, you know, after a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks of use. you know, see if you still use it instead of your laptop. Because normally around that point, you start finding things that, I need a laptop to do this.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see. More on that later. So we have an AT&T article here. We're going to be talking about phones in a second. But right now, this pseudo phone article, AT&T says they're going to start throttling people. Now, we already, you know, kind of thought that all the people grandfathered in with the unlimited data, that it really wasn't unlimited, you know, whatever. You know, everybody kind of knew that. But now AT&T is like, hey, you unlimited people, not only does unlimited not mean unlimited, but if you start using a lot of data, we are going to throttle you. And here's the worst part. You don't know when we're going to throttle you. Because they're really only going to throttle people who are in like the top 5% of data users. How do you figure that out?
Yeah.
You don't. There is no way. There is no set gigabyte limit. The top 5% changes every day. There's no way for you to know this. So
yeah,
you,
and as they throttle people, different people are going to get in the top five.
Right.
So theoretically, they could just throttle everyone. It'll eventually throttle everyone. Because it depends on how much they throttle them and by how much. And
yep. I mean, this is...
Yeah, that's asinine.
It sucks.
You know, interesting enough, I somebody had mentioned something about a broadband cap. So I got interested and looked at my Comcast service, and it does have a little meter in it.
Yeah, you can log into the website. And...
Yeah, and it, you know, it's like 250 gig.
Yep.
And I noticed like last month we used like 18 gig, and I was like, wow, I was surprised actually. You know, we use that much data. I don't know. Like, I was trying to think, recount my use. Like, I have a hard time believing that I'd use that much. You know, because I don't do a lot of streaming or downloading. I do a lot of podcast downloads, which are pretty big. But I added it up real quick in my head. You know, like 5 video podcasts once a week. It's 20 downloads, 200 each. That's like 4 gig.
Yeah, I use a lot of gig.
A lot of gig?
A lot of gig. If I do a couple photo shoots a month at like 6 gigs a photo shoot, so there's 18 gigs just in pictures, I have that backed up to the cloud. So
yeah,
minimum 18 gigs a month that I stream straight to the cloud in addition to all my other usage. So I would not get to 250 gig
because
I'm not a heavy streamer like that, but it's more than I thought, yeah. And I'm kind of glad that very soon I might be getting off of AT&T, but more to come later because you submitted a story first about Google buying Motorola.
Yes. So this is old news now. I submitted it, you know, when it came out and we hadn't done a Slonkast, but...
Yeah, this was 8 days ago.
Yeah. Wow, only 8 days? Yep. Seems like it's been forever ago.
I know.
So now, you know, Motorola Mobility was purchased by Google. Motorola has two segments. They have Motorola, I think, Services and Motorola Mobility. I think the other one's Services.
I don't know what it's called, but yeah.
But the Mobility segment, which actually, believe it or not, includes the set-top box division. I was made aware of that today by a coworker.
Hmm.
And that piqued my interest a little more in this deal, especially given that they recently acquired Sage TV, which is a DVR software company. I think they may be lining up to release something big.
Yeah.
TV-wise. Now, a lot of people look at the Mobility purchase as protecting the Android interests.
That's what I think it is.
From court cases. But I think...
Oh, I wouldn't go that far. I would... Well, go ahead with your story and...
Well, you know, there's a lot of patents that Mobility or Motorola owned that may help the Android cause in court if Google owns those patents. So that's one big theory. Another is that they're going to, you know, force the vertical integration between the devices and the software.
That's my theory, pulling the Apple model.
Right, which will help, I think, you know, but they've been forcing their hand on Honeycomb as is, and I think they've been doing a good job with that. Like, the tablets that I've used, the Honeycomb tablets, briefly, and the one that I bought, I think they're excellent. I think there's still some bugs work out. I'll admit I still have a browser crash every once in a while, but I believe it's related to Flash. I installed Flash, and it seems like when you get into a website that's really Flash heavy, It just seems like that causes some hiccups.
Yeah, here's the thing with tablets. You don't need Flash. People say, oh, you don't have the full internet. I have never once thought, boy, I wish I had Flash on my tablet. Every site that I go to that does multimedia does HTML5. I have never run into a problem where I needed Flash.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. I don't know. Maybe there's other problems that I'm having that are causing the crashes. But occasionally the Android browser will crash on me. It hasn't happened all of today, but
just my way of trying to get you to uninstall Flash because you don't need it.
Well, I could do that, but. Like, here's one example where you do need something, and this isn't Flash, it's Silverlight, which is basically Microsoft's competitor. If you want to view any of the videos on Comcast's website, it's all Silverlight.
Awesome.
Yeah. So, good luck trying to find a Silverlight install for Android at this point.
For anything.
It's coming. The Moonlight people are working on it. They've already done it for Linux, and they're working on it for Android. They're part of the Mono project. But anyway, getting back to this purchase, I do think the vertical integration is part of it, but if you look at the other aspects of what Motorola Mobility brings along with it, I just think there's a lot of strategic things that happen there. It's not just about that.
There's a lot of strategery here.
Strategery, yes, strategery. But
I my main inclination is that they're doing this to have a hold, like Apple has a hold of hardware and software. But like, whenever you brought up the point about the set-top boxes. This makes me think, does Google know that Apple is making a TV? And is Google getting ready to make a TV? Google TV.
They already kind of have that. I mean, they have...
They have TVs that integrate with the Google OS, but it's not a Google-branded TV. Like, they don't control everything.
No, it's like it's a Sony TV with Google TV installed. Yeah. And then they have that Logitech review box, which someone pointed out to me that's only $99, and it integrates with cable boxes, I guess.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it actually can control the cable box over the HDMI somehow.
That's cool.
And now that I know that, I'm like really interested because the changes, the way cable systems work now, it's sort of like made some of the Windows... based home theater PCs kind of like unusable because you need digital tuners and those aren't really available. I think that this is a crazy, I think it's bigger than anyone realizes at this point. Google has already released several statements playing down the whole vertical integration saying, no, we're going to support our other Android vendors and whatnot.
For now.
And this is kind of like, wow, but see like, you know, HTC's been building their like Nexus phones. The next one's going to be a Samsung one.
I was going to say every Nexus has been a different company.
No, there's two HTC's and then a Samsung is the new one.
Really?
Yeah.
Like the Nexus one
was HTC. The Nexus.
What was the Nexus S?
The Nexus S was HTC.
Really? I thought it was a different company. I could be wrong.
Well, maybe I'm wrong now. Maybe it was another company. But anyway, I don't know if it's so much. I think the vertical integration still helps from the standpoint, like, let's figure out the best way to build hardware. And maybe then they'll share that with the other Android maker. You know what I mean? They could still share that in the sense that here's what you need to do to get this to really work well.
Samsung was the Nexus S.
Oh, okay.
And what's the next one? Did they give it a name yet?
I don't know. There's another one coming out this fall from what?
Yeah.
Is it the Nexus Zen maybe or something like that? Or
I'm going to do a Google for new Nexus. Okay, that didn't help at all. Yeah, so whatever. Oh, they say HTC is making it. Huh, that's interesting. So they started with HTC, they went to Samsung, now they're going back to HTC.
Yeah.
At least that's the rumor.
But still, none of them are Motorola.
Right.
You know, that's...
Right.
So like, it'd be like almost a... I can't see them like being all Motorola all the time, but you know, time will tell.
Yeah, we'll see that. Ugh, that could be something to watch out for if they start doing what Apple does, and maybe they're going to kill off the other companies. Who knows? But speaking of mobile phones, and speaking of Apple, which we have a lot in this show, it seems, according to people who have found these things in the wild, that there are iPhones out there on LTE. Verizon LTE iPhones. Out in the wild.
In testing.
Yeah. Not like you or I owning them, but they are out there showing up on carriers.
They exist.
Yeah.
Well, it's a good thing. I mean, I think if if Apple, you know, I've said this and people have rebutted it before about 3G versus 2G and now 4G versus 3G and them not jumping on the 3G bandwagon anyway. This bandwagon's pretty big, I think. Maybe I'm making it out to be more, but it is. 4G is such a huge jump.
For this area, this is a 3 megabit jump or a 3 megabit speed to a minimum 14 megabit speed.
Yeah, and really that 3 megabit speed is best case.
Yeah.
Where 14 seems to be like
the low case.
Worst case.
Yeah.
So
people that I know this for a fact, I talked to them down in the DC area, 44 megabits.
Oh, is that what they get down there?
Yeah.
Wow.
Ridiculous.
On LTE.
LTE.
Wow. Yeah, they need to jump on it.
And the interesting thing about this is that we know it's in the wild, so we know iPhones are out there that work with LTE. My theory is that this is why Apple has pushed back the iPhone release date from WWDC in July to September, now to October.
Yeah.
Because they wanted a little more time for testing so that the next iPhone that comes out will be LTE. And our last article of the day says that the rumors are the new iPhone will be launched on all three major networks at the same time, Sprint, Verizon, and AT&T. So this
fits rumors we've read about them developing a world phone. The next iPhone will be a world phone. It'll work anywhere. And the only way you can say that, literally, I know GSM is widespread, but there are still like 100, well, not that many, several countries that still only have CDMA CDMA networks, but that's
one frequency of CDMA networks.
At least one frequency of CDMA networks. So,
this will be awesome that the iPhone is finally on multiple networks. I am hoping that my self-made rumor is true that the October iPhone is going to be LTE, because once it is, I am canning AT&T and switching to Verizon.
Yay.
I mean, really, the only reason I stayed on AT&T when the Verizon iPhone came out is because I didn't want to kill my contract and pay AT&T $1,000 or whatever it is to switch. But I will gladly pay the $100-some cancellation fee if it means I can have 4G speed on Verizon. Like, that's a no-brainer. As soon as it comes out, I will wait in line overnight if I have to do this. Like, that's how much I want LTE. I'm sick of slow internet speeds. And the worst part will be my phone will be faster than my home internet connection. That's what kills me. Like, sure, there's a cap, so I can't use it as a home internet connection, but still faster.
On the other hand, you could use it for your browsing and your like personal uses, and then leave the existing connection to just like the back data up to the cloud connection.
I could hook it
up.
That is, you're a genius. I could hook it up to my router somehow and have the wireless network would only be browsing over LTE, and the hardwired network would be crash plan backup to the internet.
Yeah.
Oh, you're smart.
Sometimes.
I really think I might do that. If I can find a way to get my phone network into my router without buying a separate device and paying a separate fee, I will definitely do that. Because I know one of our friends, Matt Hunt, did that. He bought a Pantech LTE modem for his home internet connection.
Yeah, he said it works pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, considering where he lives, he can only have satellite as internet. This is a big jump from like 10 kilobits a second to 16 megabits a second. But I'm definitely going to try that. So anything else that you saw over the past couple weeks?
No, I don't think so. I think we covered the big news with Steve Jobs' announcement and the
dumb HP and
one thing that's interesting, the new Lenovo ThinkPad tablet was released, which is another Android Honeycomb 3.1 at release.
It's really so Lenovo is releasing Android stuff now.
Yeah, they have two actually. They have one out there called the IdeaPad K1 that already released. I think it's only a 16 gigabyte unit though. I don't think they make anything bigger. And then they came out with the ThinkPad, which is like the next, you know, they're like business class.
Right.
It's a pretty slick looking tablet. I actually considered it until I found out something about it I didn't like. But basically, it's a 10.1 inch NVIDIA Tegra 2 device, just like the Asus. It has a lot of hard buttons on it, which is nice if people prefer hard buttons, you know, like back buttons and that sort of thing. I like them. For a lot of things, The other cool thing about it is it has it's actually you can get a 64 gig version, which is pretty unique in the Android world. There's only I think it's the only one that goes up that big. And it has a keyboard dock, but it's not as cool as the Asus one, in my opinion. It's not quite a netbook. It like has like a they call it a folio, where like it's like a leather bound thing that
right.
connects in. The worst part about it is it uses the only USB port available on
it. Oh, that sucks.
To connect it.
What in the world?
And it doesn't give you an extra one. So that killed it for me.
Why would you not do pass-through?
Like, yeah,
come on.
That killed it for me. I'm like, I want to have a little netbook that I take travel with me that I can plug a hard drive in and get to like videos or, you know, an external USB drive
right.
or whatever. You know, if I want to take some movies with me or something. So, anyway, it's a cool little tablet. It looks nice. I think it definitely is going to probably grab hold in the enterprise world. So that's kind of cool.
Very interesting. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that is it for this week's episode of the Slongcast. As usual, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter. My username is Slongcack. And Ryan, where do people go to find out about you?
You can find me on Twitter at @RyanLancey or at www.lancipedia.com.
The Lancipedia. I should have thought up a cool slogan for that, but I got nothing right now.
That's all right. Next time.
Next time. So as always, if you want us to talk about something that you see interesting, just bookmark it on Delicious. The next episode will be episode 42. So bookmark it Slongcast042 on Delicious. If you want to send us an email, you have a tech problem, you want us to answer your questions, send it to slongcast@kevinslonka.com, and we will be sure to answer anything that you send us. Anything. Well, that's it, guys.